Welcome to SCOTUSCast, a project of the Federalist Society for Law and Public Policy Studies. Our contributors join us from around the country to bring you expert commentary on U.S. Supreme Court cases as they are argued and the decisions are issued. The Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions are those of the speaker.
Hello, and welcome to SCOTUSCast. I'm your host, Kyle Hammernis, on behalf of the Faculty Division of the Federalist Society. We are here today to discuss Williams v. Reed, which was decided by the Supreme Court in a 5-4 decision on February 21st, 2025. It is my honor to introduce our guest today, Professor Tyler Lindley. Professor Lindley is an Associate Professor of Law at the J. Reuben Clark Law School at Brigham Young University. His research centers on the judicial role and historical evolution of the judiciary in America. He has extensively examined and published on judicial remedies, federal courts, constitutional law, and administrative law. And with that, I'd like to hand things over to Professor Lindley to get us started by talking about how the case got to the Supreme Court.
Thank you. So this case comes out of Alabama, and the plaintiffs are more than 20 individuals in Alabama who applied for unemployment benefits in the wake of the COVID pandemic. As you might imagine, the Alabama Department of Labor, now the Department of Workforce, was overwhelmed by a lot of the applications that came in the years following COVID. The plaintiffs had a mix of complaints about the process for claiming unemployment benefits. The primary one was that the Department of Labor, the Alabama Department of Labor, was not even processing their claims, that many of these sat for more than a year. Others argued that the notice that the Department of Labor provided them about the preliminary decisions that could be appealed within the Department of Labor were insufficient. The Alabama Department of Labor has a process that claimants need to go through. They submit an initial claim that has an initial determination, and the statute requires that determination to be made promptly, but doesn't provide a deadline. Then once that determination is made, then the claimant can appeal an adverse determination within the department, and then eventually up to the Board of Appeals, which is composed of members appointed by the governor. So this is an intricate process. Now, Alabama also allows for eventual appeals into courts of these determinations or challenges to the process. But an Alabama statute limits the judicial jurisdiction of those types of appeals. The statute essentially says that no circuit court, the state circuit court, shall permit an appeal unless that appeal has been exhausted through all of the administrative remedies. So it has to go through all of the appeal process within the Department of Labor and then can come before state court. So these plaintiffs are stuck in the administrative process, and they sue the Secretary of Labor, the Alabama Secretary of Labor, in state court under Section 1983, which is a federal law. So this federal law, Section 1983, is generally understood to provide a federal cause of action for any violation by state officials of an individual's constitutional or federal statutory rights. So these plaintiffs say that the delays in the process or the insufficient notice violate both the Due Process Clause of the Constitution and the Social Security Act, which kind of sets forth the procedures that states have to follow in administering these benefits. And so they go to state court saying, we want the state court to issue an injunction against the Secretary of Labor and the employees within the Secretary of Labor, ordering them to process these applications, or in the event of the improper notice or the insufficient notice, to fix the notice and allow an appeal. And so they want an injunctive remedy. And the Alabama courts say, well, we have an Alabama law that says all claims that come out of this, out of the Secretary of Labor, and kind of any benefits claims, need to be exhausted before we have jurisdiction. So we don't have jurisdiction. That goes to the Alabama Supreme Court. The Supreme Court says we don't have jurisdiction. and the petitioner's appeal saying, no, 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 Section 1983, this federal law that we're suing under, requires the states to hear this case, preempts the exhaustion jurisdiction rule, and we'll get into exactly whether it's an exhaustion rule or whether it's a jurisdictional rule, but preempts that and doesn't allow its application when it comes to Section 1983 claims specifically.
Great. So the case gets to the Supreme Court. Can you talk a little bit about how each side argued the case before we jump into the decision?
Yeah. So the petitioners here, the plaintiffs, those who are claiming unemployment benefits, had a broader and then a narrower argument. And the broadest argument is that although this exhaustion requirement, this requirement that the plaintiffs before going to state court have to exhaust their administrative remedies before the Secretary of Labor, that this exhaustion requirement is just categorically not allowed, even if it's framed in jurisdictional terms. And so you have a couple of cases that come beforehand that maybe kind of give a little bit of color to this. One is a case called Patsy that in which a federal court had imposed an exhaustion requirement. Often exhaustion requirements are kind of unwritten law, common law, judge made. And the Supreme Court says in Patsy, no, Section 1983 does not have an exhaustion requirement. And an exhaustion requirement is inconsistent with this scheme where plaintiffs get to go directly to federal court and get damages or equitable relief for violations of their federal rights, whether it be constitutional or statutory. So we have that case. And then we have a case called Felder that comes out of Wisconsin. And this is out of a state court, or at least out of a state law. And in Felder, what happened was there's a state law requiring a notice of the claim. Plaintiffs had to give a notice of the claim to the defendants and then let it sit for a certain amount of time before they could bring a suit. And the question was, does this law apply to a Section 1983 claim? And there was some dispute about whether that's truly an exhaustion requirement or what it might be. But the court characterizes it as an exhaustion requirement, saying you have to kind of try and attempt to make peace with the defendant by giving a notice of claim and giving them an opportunity to settle and have discussions, and said, no, that exhaustion requirement doesn't work. It's again inconsistent with Section 1983, therefore preempted, the state law is preempted, and courts can't apply that state law in Section 1983 cases. And the petitioners here say, this is, even though it's closed up in jurisdictional garb, this is an exhaustion requirement. So it just falls within this Patsy Felder line of cases that just say Section 1983 can't have an exhaustion requirement. Their narrower argument is, well, this particular exhaustion requirement, even if maybe it can apply in some instances, maybe we can at least force them to go to the administrative body, the state administrative body in some cases, it can't apply to these types of claims because these claims are challenging the process that they have to exhaust. And so it doesn't really work. And so we should just carve out these types of claims. If we were actually claiming that they had made a wrong decision, we got all the way through the appeals and they had made a wrong decision that violates the Social Security Act or some other federal provision, then maybe we have to exhaust, right? Maybe we can't just say that the initial determination before we appeal violates my federal rights. But here we're just challenging the process. We just want an order telling them to process our applications or give up me sufficient notice. We're not actually challenging the ultimate determinations. And so in that instance, this exhaustion requirement has to be preempted. Now, the state is argues kind of against both of those arguments on a somewhat broad argument, but it kind of defeats both of those arguments, which they say, hey, this is different than a typical exhaustion requirement. Although it hinges on whether you've exhausted, it deprives the court of jurisdiction. It doesn't mean that you lose. So the state says in a normal exhaustion case, a plaintiff sues, hasn't exhausted, and if the time has run by which they can't exhaust or depending on the exact exhaustion rule, then they lose on the merits. They get a dismissal with prejudice. They can't come back. It's over. That they're done. Sometimes, you know, courts will stay the case so that they can go back and exhaust. But that's but the point is that it operates on the merits. This the court has chosen to hear the case and decides the case on exhaustion grounds. They say, here, this is different. The Alabama Supreme Court, the Alabama courts, just rejected this at the jurisdictional stage, and the plaintiffs can still go to federal court, or at least arguably can, maybe with some statute of limitations complications. But they're saying this is not us adjudicating the claim and imposing an exhaustion requirement. This is just the state deciding what's the scope of state court jurisdiction. And state courts always have jurisdictional rules, right? They say small claims court can only handle these types of cases, you know, maybe circuit court or trial court or whatever it might be. We can always define our jurisdiction. And so that defeats both the petitioner's broad argument that this is an exhaustion requirement and therefore falls within Patsy and Felder, and also the narrow argument, which says maybe this is a bad idea, but it just leaves you to go to federal court, and that's just fine. We're just defining our jurisdiction. And so these are the types of arguments that are going on, which is, do we properly view this as kind of an exhaustion requirement, or is this just a run-of-the-mill jurisdictional requirement that we generally think state courts can define their jurisdiction? And it's not a matter of federal concern if a state court just doesn't have as much jurisdiction as they might otherwise have.
Great. And I guess that since you went into that distinction a little bit more in the arguments, would now be a good time to go into the decisions and see how it all came out.
Yeah.
It was a 5-4 decision, it wasn't on ideological lines at all, it seemed like. Can you just go over the majority opinion, the reasoning behind it, and then we'll go to the dissent?
Yeah. So the decision is 5-4, as you mentioned, and Justice Kavanaugh writes. He's joined by Chief Justice Roberts, Justice Sotomayor, Justice Kagan, and Justice Jackson. And so we'll talk about the dissent in a minute, which is somewhat divided. But Justice Kavanaugh does not reach the broader argument. I think he says a couple of times that it's the ground that they reach is narrow, tries to emphasize the narrowness of the decision, drops a footnote saying we are not addressing the Patsy Felder argument. So this is really it's really narrow. And so there's a line, you know, in the opening paragraph that kind of summarizes exactly where Justice Kavanaugh gets, which says, because the claimants cannot sue until they complete the administrative process, they can never sue under Section 1983 to obtain an order expediting the administrative process. Okay, so the majority opinion somewhat sets aside the insufficient notice question. I didn't see the majority opinion separating that out, but at the very least, it's enough to reverse the Supreme Court of Alabama, saying when a plaintiff in this type of instance is trying to challenge the delays in the process, it's kind of a never-ending loop that they can never actually come to state court because they aren't getting a decision, so they cannot exhaust. And what their claim is not this decision was wrong, but we're impermissibly being denied a decision. And so that is kind of where the court falls and addresses this, what it claims to be a narrow holding. But yet some of the reasoning might extend a little bit further than the majority might imagine. And that's something that the dissent says.
Great. And then I guess, as you said, the dissent was split. Justice Thomas wrote the dissenting opinion, but Justice Alito, Justice Gorsuch, and Justice Barrett only joined in part two. And then you were cited in the dissenting opinion. So if you can just touch on the dissenting opinion as a whole, and then also your citation that was in there.
Yeah. So thanks. And I think, so part one, Justice Thomas reiterates his view about how he views kind of the role of state jurisdictional limitations. And this comes back to a decision, Haywood v. Drown from 2009, that involved a state law also involving Section 1983. And so in order to kind of understand where he's coming from and where the argument with the majority is, we need to understand Haywood just a little bit. So before Haywood, we had a rule, or at least people understood there to be a rule, that as long as the state law that prohibited state courts from adjudicating a federal claim, as long as it was a neutral rule of judicial administration, then it was okay. And we understood judicial administration to be, mean it needs to be jurisdictional, meaning we're not actually reaching the merits. We're not hearing the claim and then saying no federal law applies to this claim. It's jurisdictional. It's about administration. And neutral means it needs to divide, it needs to kind of cover both state and federal claims. Not, it can't target the federal claim. It can't say our jurisdiction just doesn't extend any federal claims. Justice Thomas in Haywood in argues that actually this discrimination rule, the idea of neutral, isn't rooted in the Constitution, right? So he makes the argument that Article 3, by allowing Congress to create lower federal courts, was recognizing that state courts might not hear all federal claims and that we might need lower federal courts. Also says that the Supremacy Clause just talks about laws that conflict, but a law that just restricts jurisdiction doesn't actually conflict with a substantive law that that governs kind of what the rights and obligations of the parties are. So he also was alone and a sole dissenter. Haywood v. Drown was also a 5-4 decision. At the time, it was Justice Scalia, Chief Justice Roberts, and Justice Alito who joined Justice Thomas on the other part, but he was alone there. And he reiterates his argument in part one that that actually there's no non-discrimination requirement at all when it comes to state courts hearing federal claims. I'll get back to kind of what Haywood did, and this is where the dissenters in Williams, our case today, come back into the play. But Justice Thomas reiterates this and says, as long as it's jurisdictional, and he defines jurisdictional by meaning it's dismissed without prejudice, meaning the state courts just won't hear the claim. You can always go to federal court later, but just you can't hear it. He says, as long as it's actually jurisdictional, and I agree, he says, I agree that, you know, it can't just be nominally jurisdictional. It actually has to be jurisdictional. Then we shouldn't care about this. And because the Alabama law here about exhaustion is jurisdictional, we shouldn't care. Then, as you mentioned, he drops a footnote that goes even further and says, well, we should actually reconsider two of our additional line of cases, or at least might need to reconsider them. One is that there's even a due process problem here. So the reason why there's a due process problem is that we have a case named Goldberg v. Kelly, and then a line of cases, including Matthews v. Eldridge and others, that say sometimes government benefits or entitlements are property within the meaning of the due process clause that says no state shall, or in the Fifth Amendment, that the government shall not deprive any person of life, liberty, and property without due process of law. And Justice Thomas says, I think historically, kind of government benefits and entitlements were probably not property. You didn't have a right to them until you actually kind of received them and took a property interest in the money. And so in this case, that would obviously defeat kind of the Section 1983 claim. And then he says, we also might need to reconsider whether Section 1983 is kind of a standalone cause of action, or whether it gives federal courts jurisdiction over certain state law causes of action that implicate federal rights. And this is where he cites one of my papers. I argue that kind of as originally understood, Section 1983 was not a standalone federal cause of action that gave kind of a new and unique individual right to come to federal court. What it did was it codified the federal rights, which was needed to establish federal question jurisdiction, but then it allowed plaintiffs to bring whatever their state law claims were into federal court if those state law claims were seeking to vindicate a federal right. And that's mostly, most of that understanding is done by the backdrop where before 1938, the causes of action and actions at law were derived from state law. As a matter of statute, Congress required federal courts to look to state law to know which causes of action, or in that case, the forms of action historically would be used. But also kind of the fact that this section is very simple. It just says you can sue, the defendants shall be liable in an action at law. And what action at law, we don't know. But Justice Thomas says we should reconsider that, in which case, again, Section 1983 there is no kind of standalone claim. You'd have to go to state law, and if state law requires exhaustion, then state law requires exhaustion. You don't have a state law cause of action, so you can't bring it in federal court or in state court, because Section 1983 doesn't provide that independent cause of action. So now we get back to part two, where the dissenters join, right? And now we have Haywood. So what does Haywood say? Haywood is not, it is, it's a clear opinion, but it's unclear kind of which line of reasoning is doing the work. So Haywood is a case from New York, where New York says state courts no longer have jurisdiction over any claim for damages by prisoners against prison officials. That includes state law claims, that includes federal law claims. So the four-justice dissent in Haywood says, now again, this is a narrower view than Justice Thomas's broader view, that this is as long as it's purely jurisdictional, but they say, well, this is neutral in that sense. Then it covers state law claims and it covers federal law claims. And New York state courts are not obligated to hear a certain type of claim just because Congress wants, just because Congress has enacted a law that affects rights and obligations. And the majority says, no, that's not enough. It's not enough just to be non-discriminatory. And yet it kind of has three lines of argument, at least how I read it, that it's unclear which one's doing the work. Do you need all three? Which are they all three independent? So the first one, although it says non-discrimination is not enough to be neutral, it then kind of says, well, maybe this isn't really neutral because it's not about all Section 1983 claims. It's not about all defendants because it's only prison officials. And it's really not even about all types of claims against prison officials, because you could bring equitable claims for injunctions or other type of equitable relief. So really it's kind of gerrymandering the certain type of claim. And yes, it includes any state law claims that happen to come within that gerrymander, but really kind of we know what they're doing, right? The state law claims aren't doing a lot of work there. It's really Section 1983 that, you know, that allows kind of this claim to proceed, and then requires state courts to apply federal law, authorizes attorney's fees, all types of benefits to bring a Section 1983 claim. And the court seems to say, well, this is too gerrymandered. But then in another analysis, the court says, well, really, this kind of just works as an immunity statute clothed in jurisdictional garb, which is kind of saying, if there's a certain type of claim that just can't be brought, then we're going to be really hesitant, right? That just seems like the state is undermining federal law as a matter of effects, right? It's saying that this type of claim can't be brought, but Section 1983 allows this type of claim, and so therefore it can't be brought. And then the court also says, well, this is a unique case because New York, both in the litigation and the legislature, had said pretty explicitly, the reason why we have this rule is because we think most claims by prisoners for damages are frivolous and they waste the prison officials' times and they waste the court's times. And so the court in Haywood says, well, we don't like when this is a jurisdictional rule that is based on policy disagreement with Congress. And in that sense, it's preempted. And so we had kind of multiple lines of reasoning, and it's unclear. So let's go through those and see how the Alabama law fares, right? That's kind of how the dissent kind of goes about it. So on the first, which says this isn't really that neutral, you know, maybe it's less gerrymandered than the New York law, right? It just applies to all, you know, claims that have to do with benefits for, and so it's maybe a little less gerrymandered, but the petitioners did make the argument that it only really applied to government officials and only applied to a small subset of Section 1983 claims. So maybe it's not as neutral, right? Haywood also said, when we're thinking about what's the purpose of jurisdictional rules that we think aren't kind of trying to be gerrymandered, we think about it as competence over the subject matter and power over the person. So, you know, the petitioners here argue, well, it's really not about either of those because they can eventually hear these claims. So they must have competence over the subject matter. And the person, it's an Alabama resident and an Alabama official. There's no concern there. The dissent tries to say, well, actually, this is about concern about the subject matter. This is a specialized administrative process that courts don't know a lot about, and exhaustion helps develop the record and get to hear kind of the expertise's evaluation of the evidence before we actually get there. Now, that rebuttal does a lot of work for why there isn't such an exhaustion requirement. It's unclear what on a narrower argument why that would apply to due process violations due to delay in that process, right? Are the employees at the Department of Labor really good about knowing why there might be a delay and whether that's a due process violation? Maybe not, but it does justify why they have the jurisdictional rule to begin with. The second one, which talks about the effects, is the one that the majority latches onto. So the majority says, as I mentioned in the opening paragraph, because these claims can now never be brought, because you can't exhaust a claim that you're not processing my attempts to exhaust, as a matter of an effect, it effectually prohibits these claims from ever being brought, right? And it really kind of rests on a few quotes out of Haywood that support that. And the dissent says that was never really a different line of reasoning. If you actually understand where those quotes came from, they were really all about the purpose. They were saying New York had a policy disagreement and it expressed that policy disagreement by effectually prohibiting these claims from coming. And so the dissent says there is no evidence of purpose here, right? There's no evidence that Section 1983 claims were barred. Section 1983 claims are a very, very small portion of claims that are going to arise out of these benefits determinations. Most of them are going to be under state law or maybe under some kind of federal law, but those don't always have to be brought under Section 1983. And so the dissent says, well, this is all about purpose, and this is neutral, and therefore we should let Alabama define the scope of its court's jurisdictions, or if its court's jurisdiction. And the majority with Justice Kavanaugh says, no, in effect, this prevents a certain species of claim from being brought. And that's what Haywood was really targeting, was saying, even if it's jurisdictional and truly jurisdictional, if its effect is to prohibit a species of claim from being able to be brought in state court, then it's preempted. And that's where the majority lands.
Great thing. I mean, really great job summarizing all the different aspects at play in these opinions. Can you just touch a little bit on what you see as the consequences going forward for these types of claims, now that the case has been decided?
Yeah, so I, as I mentioned before, Justice Kavanaugh really tries to emphasize the narrowness of the opinion, saying it's really just about jurisdictional requirements that in turn require exhaustion of a claim that really can't be exhausted because it's kind of a never-ending circle. Justice Barrett asked us at oral argument, said, well, what happens if they go back and they submit a letter saying your delay is violating the Social Security Act and the due process claim and I want to kind of exhaust that? Well, one answer is the State Department of Labor gets that letter and says, oh, you're right, we need to process your claim, let's process your claim. In which case, everyone's good. We got what we wanted anyway, because all of the plaintiffs were seeking was an injunction compelling a decision. We get a decision. But what if they, in turn, sit on that letter, just like they were sitting on the initial application? Then have they exhausted? Have they not? Right. The dissent says, well, actually, Alabama law has a futility exception, so it does not prevent these from being brought at all. Once you give this Department of Labor a reasonable amount of time, then you can say exhaustion is futile, therefore I can properly bring my claim. That's not raised squarely in the case, and the majority kind of just dismisses that. But it's, once we get beyond that, we have the dissent says kind of the reasoning here is going to have great ripple effects. And the majority responds, the last substantive paragraph says, the dissent further says our opinion may have ripple effects, quoting the dissent. But as we have emphasized, our opinion today is narrow. It resolves this dispute, but is careful not to go beyond this court's existing precedents. Okay, so according to the majority, it's saying this is just a simple application of Haywood. It's a really narrow, it's just these specific types of claims that are barred, jurisdictionally barred by an exhaustion requirement. And there's nothing else. Now, the dissent says, okay, you can say that over and over again, but if your rule is it effectively prohibits a species of claim from being brought, all the work is going to be done in defining what's a species of claim. So let's say state courts say, or the state legislature says, state courts are not very good at adjudicating civil rights claims. We just don't think that they're very good for whatever reason, right? So, but the purpose of this hypothetical is it's a concern about competence over the subject matter. And so we're going to take out all civil rights claims, not federal claims, not all federal claims. It includes some federal claims can still last as long as they're not civil rights claims, and all civil rights, state and federal, right? So it's neutral. This is about the competence of the court. It's jurisdictional. They dismiss without prejudice. You can always go to federal court for these cases. What happens then? And let's put aside the constitutionality because maybe they can't prohibit state courts from hearing state civil rights cases, but let's put that aside. This law would categorically bar a species of federal claim from being brought, any Section 1983 claim, period. Now, is that allowed? Now, is that now a carve out to the idea that it's a neutral rule of judicial administration when, and we're going to second guess whether it's really neutral by looking at whether it has affects the competence of the court or the court's power over the people? Maybe, maybe not. That's obviously the kind of the end of the run hypothetical, but let's move it back a little bit to what happens if it's certain types of police encounters, state and federal. Does that count? What happens if it's certain types of administrative law claims, okay, where the legislature just says state courts aren't very good at administrative law claims. Does this effectively, is does is would those types of rules effectively foreclose a species of federal claim from being brought in state court? Maybe, maybe not, but that's where all the work is going to be going forward. And now, having said that, even if the court interprets that claim very fairly broadly, there just aren't very many of these cases, right? I mean, we have Haywood that comes down in 2009. This is the first case the Supreme Court has gotten since then. There are other ones that have floated around the circuit courts, but it's unclear to me whether this is a big area of litigation, right? Are there lots of state laws that don't clearly fall on one side or the other? I'm not sure. Maybe state courts are going to be less adventurous in trying because of this decision. But I'm not sure that they were beforehand either. And so as far as practical effects on a broader scale, not sure how much this does, but as far as within this narrow world of Section 1983 claims in state court, it depends on how we interpret the majority's rule. It's clear what the majority is saying. There are certain types of narrow claims that a particular species of narrow claims that you can't, the state court can't effectively prohibit from coming to state court. And yet, we don't know almost anything about where that line is. We have a couple of examples in Haywood and now in Williams v. Reed, but we're left with some unanswered questions that, again, because of the background of this, maybe we don't ever actually see answered because this isn't really an area where state courts are pushing, the boundaries.
Right. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Tyler. It's always great to see you.
Great. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. SCOTUSCast is a project of the Federalist Society, a not-for-profit educational organization of conservative and libertarian law students, law professors, and lawyers. Founded upon the principles that the state exists to preserve freedom, that the separation of governmental powers is essential to our Constitution, and that it is emphatically the province and duty of the judiciary to say what the law is, not what it should be. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast series, including SCOTUSCast and Practice Group Podcasts, on iTunes or Google Play. For an archive of past podcasts, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at fedsoc.org/multimedia. That's FEDSOC.org/multimedia.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.